session number 28361, reel 47.
General Julian Thompson, reel 47.
You were saying that Tupara didn't get the order changing the timing for their landing. Were you aware that they hadn't got the order?
Well, we were aware because every unit on being sent an order, at the bottom of it is the magic word ACK, which means acknowledge. And we'd had an ACK from everyone except Tupara. And my staff came to me and said, they haven't acknowledged it. I said, well, you better resend it. And at that moment, of course, we went into radio silence, so there was a problem. And at the same time, they caused their ship, they were in the Norland, to flash up, fearless, to say something like, do you know something we don't, or some cryptic message. So we realised they didn't know, and at the same time they realised that there was something going on. So a message was sent across and fired across to them using a Costin gun line, which is a way of passing messages at sea, in a bit of paper. So it was a more modern version of a chap with a cleft stick. So they did get the order eventually.
But they got the order somewhat later than would have been desirable.
Yes, I mean, there was actually plenty of time, and they got it in during the morning, I think, of D-1. And it didn't actually, I wouldn't have thought, cause a huge amount of problem.
They were not one of the battalions that had to move ship, were they?
No, they weren't. They were in Norland. So they
knew their way around.
They knew their way around, and they were going to do it. And all the order was giving them was the fact that it's tomorrow, chaps, and the time is. The plan didn't change. Nothing else changed.
But they always seem to refer to this as if it was a major disruptive factor.
Well, I think I can see their point, because they're operating in a totally strange environment to them. They are late arrivals. They arrived in Ascension only 12 hours before we sailed on, so they didn't have time to get assimilated into the brigade in quite the same way as the three para had, do rehearsals and so forth. So here they were, about to go to a place they'd never seen before in their lives. Many of them probably hadn't even heard of it a few weeks previously, to land from a converted, not even converted, land from a cross-channel ferry into landing craft into which they'd only ever done one practice in daylight. So I can imagine their apprehension and slight feeling of disorientation, and the last thing they needed was to suddenly think that they had been left out and people weren't bothering about them, which of course wasn't the case.
But their motto is ready for anything, isn't it?
Indeed. But then, of course, I mean, in a battalion, you always think the staff are bloody idiots anyway, so this merely reinforced that view.
Is that the staff at all levels, brigade and up?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, so you were approaching the final run-in for the landings. You've got the plan to deal with the enemy artillery on Fanning Head.
Enemy gun it was on Fanning Head.
Yes.
Enemy.
Was it just one?
It was 105 recoilless gun. Sort of Argentine equivalent of the Wombat. Only smaller, of course.
That might have made a mess of a
well, that would have made a mess of a landing craft. It might have even actually made a mess of the shipping, because you've got to remember that earlier in South Georgia, the gallant marine detachment had fired on a Argentine frigate using a Carl Gustav, and had holed it below the waterline. In fact, if they'd hit the bridge, they might have spoiled their day totally. So a 105 anti-tank round hitting a ship could cause a huge amount of damage, actually.
Well, this is on account of ships no longer being heavily armoured.
Exactly.
Indeed, because
ships are no longer heavily armoured. So, I mean, an anti-tank round into the side of Canberra or into the upper works of Canberra would have been a major problem.
Was the bombardment at Fanning Head to precede the landing, or was it to be simultaneous?
No, it was preceding it. The plan for Fanning Head, which was rigged together at really pretty much the last moment,
yes,
was that the SBS would land well away from Fanning Head by helicopter, in order not to give away the fact they were doing so at night. They would join up with the SBS party that was already in the area that had reported this thing in the first place. And with the SPS would land a naval gunfire support observation officer, Hugh McManus, and he would bring fire down from Antrim onto the enemy positions. And then another factor was which actually complicated matters and didn't help at all, was introduced, was the idea, in fact, of OCSBS, that we should try and get these guys to surrender before any battle took place. And this was all based on the example at South Georgia, where a bit of naval gunfire had persuaded the Argentines to surrender without firing a shot, and he wanted to sort of replicate this. I wasn't actually terribly in favour of it, but I can't wash my hands of it, because eventually I agreed, and therefore it was my responsibility. So they took with them a sort of rigged-up loudhailer, and the Spanish interpreter, Rod Bell, who was a captain in my headquarters, went with them, and the plan was that he would shout to them, "Surrender or you'll die," or some similar sort of Spanish threat, followed by a salvo of gunfire near them, followed by the next one will be on top of you if you don't hold your hands up. Now the problem was that A, the loud hailer didn't work very well, and secondly, so they may not have, and there was quite a high wind, or there was quite a breeze blowing, so they may not have heard what he was trying to say. I don't know. Anyway, they didn't surrender, so eventually a battle had to take place.
What was the impulse behind that desire?
The impulse behind it...
Was it humanitarian concern?
It was really, actually, to sort of test the temperature of the water, to see what sort of morale these guys had. I mean, it was a sort of testing the temperature of the water to see, were these guys going to be a pushover or not? Because if they had surrendered then, maybe the next time we came across them, a bit of gunfire would get them to chuck their hands in, which of course didn't prove to be the case at all. So I think, in reflection, it was a rather silly idea, but I can't blame anyone else other than myself, because I actually approved it. It wasn't my idea, but I approved it, so effectively it was my idea.
Well, it was an idea you had adopted.
It's an idea I'd adopted.
Your natural idea was
I thought it was a bit of a waste of time, but I thought, well, let's try it. The other interesting thing about that operation was that it was the first, as far as I know, operational use of thermal imaging, because a huge thermal imaging piece of kit had been sent out.
Was this the thing called Twiggy?
Well, I think it was called Twiggy, but it was big. Yeah. And it was mounted in, temporarily, for this operation, an anti-submarine helicopter, Antrim's anti-submarine helicopter, who overflew the position that night, literally a couple of hours before the operation was mounted, and it showed where the locations of the enemy were. The problem you had to cope with, of course, in the Falklands was, were they sheep or were they people? Because all you got was little sort of amoeba-like dots of light which showed that they weren't, that it was something alive. And the only way you got a clue as to whether they were people was they were sort of, were the sheep in tactical formation or were they people? Mm. So that operation was, to answer your question, actually started before the landing began. In fact, I saw it going on, in the sense that when the ships came down into Falkland Sound, though they'd been missed at the entrance, which caused a bit of a problem, because in fact Fearless overshot the entrance, and so we were late coming in.
Mm. Well, they had to turn around and...
Turn around and come back. Mm. She then anchored, not in San Carlos Water, but outside off Chancho Point, which is outside the entrance of San Carlos Water, but inside Falkland Sound, which is a long... I don't know whether a map would be of some use at this point, but outside there. Shall I just show you?
A long, narrow sleeve.
A long, narrow sleeve. Yeah, indeed.
How were they navigating to miss it? Were they navigating visually or by dead reckoning?
I'm not sure how they were navigating. They had to come down through there, and they overshot the entrance and did that. They were not using radar because
of the signature.
And in fact, what made them realize they overshot it was that the navigator of... I don't know if you want to have this on. Are we on tape or not?
We are, yes, of course.
The navigator of Fearless had borrowed, in quotation marks, a GPS, which was quite a new piece of kit. It was a yachtsman's GPS. And he was able to say, hey, we're overshot. So they turn around. But that actually caused a slight delay. And they anchored off here, off yes. Chancho Point. Fanning Head is there.
Yes.
And from Fearless here, I went up onto the bridge. And it was by then a lovely sort of starlit night. And I watched the flashes of gunfire from Antrim on here. And I could hear the sort of bump, bump, bump of the shells exploding. And this was before we'd started launching the landing craft.
So it's preemptive bombardment.
This, in order to take these chaps out, yeah.
When the Fearless had to turn, I mean, did it disrupt the formation of the rest of the
I don't task think so,
force?
I don't think so. I mean,
that's a rather narrow entrance, isn't it?
It is quite narrow, yeah.
So it would be easy to
I mean, you'd have to ask Captain of Fearless or or Mike Clapp.
Yes.
I mean, I wasn't paying too much attention at the time to what they were doing, because it wasn't my business.
Mm.
And the ships then anchored here. And started.
We're anchoring really off in Ajax Bay, and then you've got your.
No, not in Ajax Bay. Ajax Bay is there.
Oh, I see.
There.
Right.
No, okay. We're anchoring there.
Right. Just off Fanning Head.
Yeah, I can get another map actually if you like. Do you want to stop there?
Hmm.
Right. No, the ship's anchored outside here, in Falklands Harbour, but outside San Carlos Water, and the first two waves were actually launched from inside here, from outside.
They had to go through.
They had to go around the corner. You can see how vulnerable they were.
Absolutely.
To an anti-tank gun mounted there, which isn't, you see, that distance isn't very far across there.
What sort of timings are we talking about with regard to this operation on Fanning Head? Your team of SPS and the gunfire support officer went ashore.
Yeah.
How were they going to establish contact with the people who were already on shore waiting for them?
Because the people on shore were told by radio to expect them.
Ah.
And they had been watching Port San Carlos for quite a long time. And they then provided a reception party for them. And they landed them around here. Which was quite a long way away from boats,
yes.
Actually.
How did they signal to them offshore as they were approaching? Were they using light signals?
No. Yeah. What do you mean, the...
The reception committee ashore.
The reception committee ashore had a... used a radio to tell the helicopter they could see it coming, to come to where they were.
So they talked it in?
They talked it in, yeah.
So the helicopter went in, dropped off its party. Presumably they then had to make a move towards Fanning Head.
They then had to walk to Fanning Head.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you need to talk to someone who was on the party, someone like Hugh McManus, who can describe it to you.
Was that Hugh McManus from the artillery?
Yeah. Dress, if you like.
Yeah.
But he was with them, so he's the chap to talk to. Actually, so was Jonathan Thompson, who was the OCSBS. He was there too. And there are quite a lot of people whose names I can give you who can describe the Fanning Head operation in detail.
The gun position at Fanning Head with this Argentine weapon in it, was it properly dug in and protected?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
So they'd just got a few guys there with a recoil rifle.
It was about half a company because there was a company.
It
was about half a company because the Argentines had a company in this place, Port San Carlos.
Right.
This is the only Argentine troops that were permanently anywhere in this area here. And half the company were on Fanning Head, and in fact three para and my helicopters encountered the other half when they landed, and I can talk about that later, because they pushed off in that direction.
Were these infantrymen, were they army or were they from the Argentine Marines?
No, they were Argentine Infantry Company.
Yeah, and were they properly dug in and
round
entrenched?
Here? Yes. I think their defensive positions were pretty rudimentary, like most of the Argentine positions were. Yeah.
So the guys went up, and the loud hail, you think, didn't really work very effectively.
No. Yes.
Did they get any sort of response back from the...
They got a few bullets back. Yeah.
They had the...
The hostile answer.
Yeah, they had the hostile answer, which they then brought down naval gunfire on.
How many rounds did Antrim?
I can't remember. I don't know.
It was a longish bombardment or a short?
Well, it certainly went on for, as far as I could see, because I was watching it, as I say, from Fearless. It certainly went on for an appreciable length of time.
Yes. What was the idea of that? Was it suppressive or was it destructive?
The idea originally was to frighten them into giving up.
Yeah,
and after that, it was then going to be suppressive, because I didn't think the chances of actually hitting the 105 at night, remembering that the chaps is spotting, probably can't see the thing. He knows the general area of where these guys are.
Well, what he'd be the flashes of the arriving shell.
He'd see the flashes of the arriving shell, but he wouldn't see whether they were actually absolutely bang on target, because actually locating exactly where they were didn't really happen until daylight. Mm. And they didn't actually surrender until daylight.
Oh.
And some of them pushed off, some of them ran off and were rounded up as many as two or three days later.
Oh. So they presumably they had been frightened off by the gunfire.
Yes, I mean they didn't achieve what they were trying to achieve at all.
So I suppose you could say really that with this business with the Antrim that it neutralised them.
It neutralised them, yes, it didn't destroy them. No, it neutralised them.
Because it's only the one gun, isn't it, on the Antrim, the 4.5?
No, days. Antrim actually has. Antrim was a DLG. A ship which doesn't exist anymore, which is effectively like a light cruiser. And if you like, I'll go and look up how many guns she had. Shall I do that? A county class guided missile destroyer. Armed for 6,200 tons, 520 feet long, two 4.5 inch guns, two 20 millimeter Oerlikons, a Sea Slug missile Seacat system, and four Exocets.
But presumably this was the 4.5 inch.
This is a 4.5 inch, 4.5 inch.
Yeah.
And she had two of them.
Yeah.
So she had more than one. So that's Antrim.
That would put down a reasonable rate of fire, but it's a point target really, isn't it? Rather than an area target.
That's Hugh McManus's sketch of it.
Ah. Yes.
I hadn't got my thing on. Do you want me to read out Antrim's vital statistics?
I think that should be all right.
Yeah.
So the Beach Recce Party moves off towards St. Carlos settlement. Firing heard. Antrim opened fire. Yes. What was the means of communication from the shore party to the ship? Was this standard HF?
Well, the
radio.
The NGFOs had HF radios. I mean, they have a communication system to talk to the firing ship, in order to correct fire and so on. But if you want to get the detailed story of Fanning Head, I think it's
described in McManus's memoirs.
It's described in McManus, and also you can go and have a chat to him.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure he'd be delighted to talk about it.
Yes, well, I'm sure that would be very productive.
And there they are, actually looking at the thermal imaging pictures before they go ashore.
Yeah.
There is Hugh McManus actually on Fanning Head, and there are the prisoners with Rod Bell interrogating them on Fanning Head. Those that they caught, because quite a lot of them ran off in the darkness.
From the photograph here, there doesn't really seem to be anything in the way of a formal defensive layout.
Well, no, I mean, what they've done is they've just taken the prisoners have been taken away to one side.
Yes.
And Hugh would be able to tell you, or one of the chaps who took part in it, what the layout was like. I don't know what it was like. I never went there.
Do you know if they were forthcoming when they were interrogated, or were they resistant? And
I think they were fairly forthcoming, actually.
So Fanninghead had been neutralised. So that threat to the landings had gone.
It's
that
gone.
Was, that was cancelled out.
That
by,
finished. But
by action.
At the same time, we didn't wait for them to tell us that they'd succeeded, because we just reckoned they would be sufficiently diverted.
Yeah.
To not take too much notice of what we were up to.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the whole point, isn't it? Even if
sure.
they're not damaged at all,
sure.
they have other things to think
they
about.
They have other things to think about. Exactly.
And in any case, if it was at night, would they be likely to have any thermal imaging equipment?
Well, no, they didn't. They did actually have some quite good night vision equipment.
Did they?
The Argentines, rather better than ours.
Mm.
And they could also, by that time, they would have heard ships anchoring.
Yes.
You know, cables rattling out and boats being lowered and a sort of putt of engines and that sort of thing. So they wouldn't have had any difficulty in identifying that something was going on were they not being kept busy in another direction.
Yeah. Would those sounds have been covered and blanked out by the bombardment? Presumably they would if there were shells going on.
They would have done to some extent, but that wasn't the purpose of the bombardment.
No.
Because... you know, it would have been foolish to rely upon the bombardment carrying doing that.
Mm.
And of course, bombardments of the coast at various points, not here but other places, has been carried out in the preceding weeks anyway. So bombarding, a ship bombarding somewhere, didn't necessarily signal that you were interested in doing something in that place.
Mm. Yes, there have been the bombardments around Stanley, haven't there?
Indeed, and in many other places around the coast.
Yeah. And had the purpose of those been to create uncertainty, or had it been to affect morale on the ground, and we're here and we're shelling you?
Both.
Or both?
Yeah, both.
Yeah. So it would signal determination, and it would also keep them worried. And
as to where we were interested.
Yes.
Yes.
So it's maintaining alternative objectives, which is a...
Yes, yeah. I mean, to keep them guessing as to where we were going to go.
Yeah. Thinking back on it... overall, do you think that they had a firm appreciation of their own of where you were most likely to land? Had they taken a Clausewitzian view and thought that you were most likely to land near Stanley, or were they thinking more in terms of an indirect approach to the other side of the island?
I, with my staff, worked out that they would think that we would land nearby, largely because they'd been trained, particularly their Marines had been trained by the Americans, and also they had armoured tracked landing craft, Amtraks, which they had used to invade the Falkland Islands in the first place, and they apparently didn't realise that we hadn't. I mean, all they had to do was look up in Jane's Fighting Ships or The World or whatever to recognise that we didn't. And the reason that we think that they thought we had them was that they took great trouble to mine a beach, which they themselves used, which we would never have landed on because we couldn't, because the beach gradient was too shallow, and you could only land it on it if you had armoured track vehicles.
Rather like the Buffalo, the second one.
Yeah, it was exactly the same, only a more sophisticated thing. And now you couldn't land landing craft on it unless you wanted to have about a half mile wade up to your neck, because the beach gradient was so shallow. So the layout of their defences said to me, this is what they're expecting. I thought that's what they thought. And in fact, we were proved right by when we captured all their documents and when we saw the way they reacted to us, that they thought that that's what we would do, because they did the old cry of putting into the enemy's minds what you would do. In other words, the enemy's going to do what you do. A familiar trap to fall into. The other thing was that because of their command structure, they had no overall proper joint command, though they had set up a sort of joint command in Argentina, which was meant to control the whole of the operations in the South Atlantic. In fact, it was a total disaster, because it didn't actually do that at all. And you had conflict between the Navy, Army, and Air Force in the Argentine. And they did think, we discovered when we got at their headquarters papers, that we might land here was one of the places they thought of that we might land. Now, clearly,
to the north side of Panning
Yeah, Air. Clearly they thought that was. They thought it was a possible landing place. Unfortunately, they hadn't ever looked at their charts, or rather, they never asked a chap dressed in dark blue, because that place is called Fowl Bay, and it's marked as such. And the reason it's Fowl Bay is because there are reefs running out here, so he wouldn't land there. So that's a good example of, you know, the khaki didn't talk to the dark blue and ask them a simple question like, is this a good place to land? You know, they just looked at it as being a possible place to land. So, a rather long way of answering your question. They were not prepared for the indirect approach.
But that, and you see, this lack of coordination from on the Argentinian side went all the way right up to the junta, didn't it?
Yes.
Because Galtieri and Lemidozo and Anaya don't seem to have been on very good terms.
No.
And therefore, perhaps that feeling of rivalry went all the way down the chain of command to the.
Yes. I mean, this is what I've learned since. I didn't realise this at the time, of course.
When you were planning, were you trying to put yourself into the mind of the Argentinian
commanders? Yes. I mean, I'll come on to it later, but the whole approach that we had was predicated on the belief that they thought that we were going to come from a different direction. And in fact, again, I'm jumping ahead a bit, but the LSLs in Fitzroy, which was the Galahad and wrongly called by the media the Bluff Cove incident, merely served to reinforce the Argentine belief that that was the way the attack was coming. Again, we didn't go to Fitzroy in order to reinforce that belief, but it just did it, and it comes back to that thing with which you'll be totally familiar, that deception doesn't really work unless you're reinforcing the belief of the person. That's what you're going to do.
You can't create a new idea.
You can't create a new idea. You've got to reinforce an old one.
Yeah. So Fanning Head was suppressed, and the Argentines, some of them were dispersed, and the rest were discouraged.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't realise that this was going on.
No.
But all I could see, and was getting reports, were bringing down fire, and I wasn't all that interested, quite frankly, in the sense that they were being kept busy. Let's get on with the main business of the night, as it were.
And how was the main business going?
Well, the main business was
to plan.
It was going to plan, but slowly. For example, Fearless managed to dock down and flood her dock, but then the machinery broke down, so it looked as if she was going to have to remain docked down, you know, until it was repaired. Now, the ship can move when it's docked down, but not very fast.
Yeah.
But, I mean, again, that wasn't my problem. That was, I didn't sort of think about it all that. That was the Navy's problem. There's nothing I could do about it.
So it was over to Commodore Clapp and the
Captain. Well, and to the Captain of Fearless. Now, so it's a dark night, but with starlight, and therefore you can see quite well. And I go, there's no point in hanging around in the ops room because there's nothing to do in there. Much better to do what I did, which was go down to the tank deck and watch the chaps getting into the landing craft and talk to the Marines getting into the landing craft. And they, what they're doing is collecting grenades down in the tank deck and priming their grenades down in the tank deck. You don't want them sort of priming grenades all over the ship. Collecting 81mm mortar bombs, because each company was detailed to take a certain amount of mortar bombs with them, which they dumped on the beach as soon as they landed, which gave the mortars an initial supply of ammunition to. Each landing craft had a CVRT of the Blues and Royals in the front of it, the idea being that if there was anything on the beach, you lowered the ramp and fired a few rounds off the front of the land in a sort of Heath Robinson version of a landing craft gun at them, which you hope would, you know, make them think again.
And did they actually fire over the ramp as
they were
running
they couldn't fire, as far as I remember, they couldn't fire over the ramp. They could fire sort of like that, but it wouldn't be direct fire. I think the ramp actually got in the way of the gunner.
Yeah.
So you just had to half lower it, that's all, which you could do quite easily.
Yeah.
If you were going slowly, as you were coasting in, you could half, because you do that anyway, you start lowering the ramp as you come in. and the troops were, the landing craft are in the dock, so they climb in and get themselves sorted. It takes quite a long time, actually, to get four rifle companies plus 600 plus men into landing craft, 200 men per four landing craft plus your CVRTs. You're talking about 600 chaps.